Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Big Book of Jack the Ripper, edited and with an introduction by Otto Penzler, read by Nigel Patterson and Esther Wayne. Introduction. While the world has had no shortage of murderers, with Cain wasting no time in getting humanity started on its blood-stained path, none has imposed himself on the public consciousness as indelibly as Jack the Ripper. Most experts, known in this very specific area of scholarship as ripperologists, believe that the fiend committed his atrocities during a relatively short period of time in 1888, yet his sobriquet still resonates throughout the world today. It is reasonable to ask why this remains true after more than a century and a quarter. Certainly, there have been countless other killers whose names have screamed at us in headlines over the years, holding our attention for a while before fading and, mostly, disappearing. We may remember Adam Lanza now for having committed the incomprehensible slaughter of 20 children and 6 adults at a school in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, but only devoted scholars of crime will recall Andrew Kehoe, who murdered 38 children and 5 adults when he blew up a school in Michigan in 1927. American gangsters such as Al Capone, Bonnie and Clyde, Whitey Bulger, Babyface Nelson, Machine Gun Kelly and John Gotti are legendary figures in America, but are virtually unknown in the rest of the world. The same is largely true for the icons of the old Western frontier, where Jesse James, Billy the Kid, the Younger Brothers and Doc Holliday became the subject of purple prose newspaper accounts that captivated East Coast readers, leading to dime novels and motion picture portrayals that reimagined vicious thugs as semi-heroic characters. None of these villains sends a chill down the spine, as popular media have sanitized their reputations and deeds. Equally uninspiring of horror in the present time are British killers such as Fred and Rose West, who are known to have tortured and murdered at least 11 women and girls until they were brought to trial in 1994, their exploits garishly recounted in the news media. Also, the merest footnote to the history of serial killers is Dr. Harold Shipman, reputedly the murderer of approximately 250 people, mostly his patients, whose wills he forged so that he could inherit their valuables. Some may recall the newspaper's colourful title of the Moore's Murderers, but few remember the real names of Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, described at her trial as the most evil woman in Britain. Other names that became famous at one time, mainly because they became the subjects of books or movies, are Burke and Hare, gravediggers who were paid for corpses for medical examination and soon found it easier to kill people than dig them up. Constance Kent, who murdered a child when she was 16, a case so notorious in its time, 1860, that elements were used by Wilkie Collins in The Moonstone, by Charles Dickens in The Mystery of Edwin Drood, and in numerous other novels. Peter William Sutcliffe, better known as the Yorkshire Ripper, convicted of murdering 13 women. And Madeleine Smith, whose trial for poisoning her lover allowed her freedom when the jury returned a verdict of not proven. She was sensationalised in Wilkie Collins' The Law and the Lady, and in the 1950 David Lean film Madeleine. Better known in the United States, often because journalists bestowed colourful names on them, are such infamous serial killers as the Hillside Stranglers, Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Buono, the Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, the co-ed killer, Edmund Kemper, the BTK, Bind, Torture and Kill killer, Dennis Rader, the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, the Milwaukee Cannibal, Jeffrey Dahmer, the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway, John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy, prolific murderers who somehow eluded colourful titles, and Charles Manson, probably the most fearsome American psychopath of the 20th century. His crimes splashed along headlines for years, partially because of the unspeakable brutality of the crimes, and partially because of the fame and beauty of one of the victims, Sharon Tate. There is a seemingly limitless number of people who have committed untold numbers of heinous acts throughout the long history of Homo sapiens, a species almost unique in its ability to kill within the species for the sheer pleasure of it. With so many others having murdered in even greater numbers than Jack the Ripper, and some equally brutal, or worse, engaging in unspeakably depraved torture of living victims, a practice almost entirely eschewed by Saucy Jack, why does he continue to maintain his place at the top of the public's radar? While students of criminology are not unanimous in attributing the number of the Ripper's victims, with five apparently accepted universally, but one, two, three, or four others also credited to him by various scholars, it is generally agreed that all the murders occurred during the autumn of 1888, again with outliers claiming at least an additional year at either end. The victims were all prostitutes in London's East End, a ghetto teeming with the poorest segment of the population. The dark, narrow alleyways, often ending in cul-de-sacs, were perfect venues in which to commit an act of violence, or a transaction of a sexual nature, performed by a member of the largest profession of the neighbourhood. The noxious fumes of coal stoves and fireplaces, as well as the factories located in the area, combined to provide an almost permanently darkened sky, a smog known as London Particular. The women of the night, prowling the streets, looking for partners to pay them enough for a glass of warming gin, were perfect victims, willing, no, eager, to slip off to a darkened corner to quickly ply their trade. Although police patrolled regularly throughout the night, it was seldom the cream of the force, and the odds of them catching a criminal in the act, with visibility frequently limited to 2 or 3 feet, were slim. Since so few cared about the victims of the Ripper's carnage while they were alive, why has their fate continued to resonate today? A likely reason is that he was never caught. Having spread a tsunami of terror for a short time, he disappeared completely, leaving his identity to be theorised, discussed, argued, and written about for decade after decade. It did not hurt his legacy of notoriety that he frequently taunted the police with the complicity of the local press by sending letters warning them of forthcoming attacks and daring them to catch him if they can. The frisson of terror evoked by his name, Jack the Ripper, so much more chilling than merely Jack the Killer or Jack the Stabber, stays in the memory and on the tongue so easily. He was written about in such extreme terms, first of course in newspapers, but then in magazine articles and books, that he provided endless fodder for those who became intrigued by him. Theories about his identity were rampant, with clues clutched to advance one theory, while other possible pieces of evidence were ignored if they suggested that someone else was the genuine article. Other ripperologists rushed to discredit the first theory and advance their own, which suffered the same fate at the hands of still other students of the crimes. Jack the Ripper has now been proven to be any one of at least half a dozen people by various authors and scholars. This collection has articles describing the area of the atrocities, accounts of the murders, and theories about the identity of Red Jack, by some of the world's leading experts on the subject. There are also contemporary reports from newspapers of the day. Taken together, they will provide a reasonably clear picture of the real-life events that inspired so much fiction about the incidents and the demented individual at the heart of them. For the most comprehensive guide to all the facts, if you are interested to hear in far greater detail than offered here, I recommend The Complete Jack the Ripper by Donald Rumbelow. The fiction contained in this tome has a wide range. While planned as a volume of crime stories, the almost mythical level at which Jack has been perceived has compelled me to include some of the memorable tales that present him as ageless as his reputation. Many theories about why Jack quit so abruptly have suggested he moved to a different country or to a different time. It was impossible to resist these stories by several masters of the form. Finally, proving yet again that Jack the Ripper is as timeless as fear, there are new stories written especially for this volume by some of today's most distinguished authors. Jeffrey Deaver, Lauren D. Esselman, Lindsay Fay, Stephen Hunter, Anne Perry and Daniel Stashar. And I am grateful to them all for adding to the literature about one of the most singularly vile creatures ever to degrade the planet. Prepare to be unnerved. Otto Penzler. The True Story. The Jack the Ripper Murders. Anonymous. The atrocities, collectively known as the Jack the Ripper Murders, did wonders for the newspapers of London, which sold frequent updates to an ever-eager public, issuing new editions at the slightest hint of any scant scrap of new evidence, or more likely, speculation, gossip, and outright creative fantasy. 50 daily newspapers in that overcrowded city vied for the attention of readers, sending out newsboys in droves, screaming out the latest headlines. Each murder was a boon to Fleet Street, and none capitalised on it more than the relatively staid Times. Even at the height of the frenzy for greater and greater titillation, as reporters struggled to outdo each other with more and more lurid descriptions of the grisly slaughters, the Times continued its reportage with adherence to rudimentary journalistic practices of accuracy and as much completeness as possible under the circumstances. The following narrative provides much of the basic information as it came to light in contemporary accounts published in the Times. They were collected and reprinted as a single chapter, one of 28, in a book edited by Richard Barker, 1902-1968, more than half a century later, reflecting the reading public's never-ending interest in Red Jack. The Jack the Ripper Murders accounts were first published in the Times, London, August the 10th to November the 22nd, 1888. They were first collected in The Fatal Caress, edited by Richard Barker, New York, Duell, Sloan and Pierce, 1947. The Jack the Ripper Murders. Anonymous. The first murder, April the 3rd. Victim, Emma Elizabeth Smith. Not reported in the Times. The second murder, August the 7th. Victim, Martha Tabram. Place, Grove Yard Buildings. August the 10th. Yesterday afternoon, Mr. G. Collier, Deputy Coroner for the Southeastern Division of Middlesex, opened an inquiry respecting the death of the woman who was found on Tuesday last, with 39 stabs on her body at Grove Yard Buildings, Whitechapel. Dr. T. R. Killeen said that he was called to the deceased and found her dead. She had 39 stabs on the body. She had been dead some 3 hours. The left lung was penetrated in 5 places, and the right lung was penetrated in 2 places. The heart, which was rather fatty, was penetrated in 1 place. The liver was healthy, but was penetrated in 5 places. The spleen was penetrated in 2 places, and the stomach, which was perfectly healthy, was penetrated in 6 places. The witness did not think all the wounds were inflicted with the same instrument. It was one of the most dreadful murders anyone could imagine. The man must have been a perfect savage to inflict such a number of wounds on a defenceless woman in such a way. The third murder, August the 31st. Victim, Mary Ann Nichols. Place, Bucks Row. September the 1st. Another murder of the foulest kind was committed in the neighbourhood of Whitechapel in the early hours of yesterday morning, but by whom and with what motive is at present a complete mystery. At 3:45, Police Constable Neil, when in Bucks Row, Whitechapel, came upon the body of a woman lying on a part of the footway, and on stooping to raise her up in the belief that she was drunk, he discovered that her throat was cut almost from ear to ear. She was dead, but still warm. He procured assistance, and at once sent to the station and for a doctor. Dr. Llewellyn, whose surgery is not above 100 yards from the spot, was aroused, and at a solicitation from a constable, dressed and went at once to the scene. He made a hasty examination, and then discovered that, besides the gash across the throat, the woman had terrible wounds in the abdomen. The police have no theory with respect to the matter, except that a gang of ruffians exists in the neighbourhood, which, blackmailing women of the unfortunate class, takes vengeance on those who do not find money for them. They base that surmise on the fact that, within 12 months, 2 other women have been murdered in the district by almost similar means, one as recently as the 6th of August last, and left in the gutter of the street in the early hours of the morning. The 4th murder, September the 8th. Victim, Annie Chapman. Place, Hanbury Street. September the 10th. Whitechapel and the whole of the east of London have again been thrown into a state of intense excitement by the discovery early on Saturday morning of the body of a woman who had been murdered in a similar way to Mary Ann Nichols at Buck's Row on Friday week. In fact, the similarity in the 2 cases is startling, as the victim of the outrage had her head almost severed from her body and was completely disemboweled. This latest crime, however, even surpasses the others in ferocity. The scene of the murder, which makes the 4th in the same neighbourhood within the past few weeks, is at the back of the house 29 Hanbury Street, Spitalfields. This street runs from Commercial Street to Baker's Row, the end of which is close to Buck's Row. The house, which is rented by a Mrs. Amelia Richardson, is let out to various lodgers, all of the poorer class. In consequence, the front door is open both day and night, so that no difficulty would be experienced by anyone in gaining admission to the back portion of the premises. Shortly before 6 o'clock on Saturday morning, John Davis, who lives with his wife at the top portion of number 29, went down into the backyard, where a horrible sight presented itself to him. Lying close up against the wall, with her head touching the other side of the wall, was the body of a woman. Davis could see that her throat was severed in a terrible manner, and that she had other wounds, of a nature too shocking to be described. The deceased was lying on her back, with her clothes disarranged. Without nearer approaching the body, but telling his wife what he had seen, Davis ran to the Commercial Street police station and gave information to Inspector Chandler, who was in charge of the station at the time. That officer, having dispatched a constable for Dr. Phillips, repaired to the house accompanied by several other policemen. The body was still in the same position, and there were large clots of blood all round it. It is evident that the murderer thought he had completely cut the head off, as a handkerchief was found wrapped round the neck, as though to hold it together. There were spots and stains of blood on the wall. One or more rings seemed to have been torn from the middle finger of the left hand. A minute search being made of the yard, a portion of an envelope stained with blood was found. It had the crest of the Sussex Regiment on it, and the date London, August the 20th, but the address portion, with the exception of the one letter M, was torn off. In addition, 2 pills were also picked up. The police believe that the murder has been committed by the same person who perpetrated the 3 previous ones in the district, and that only 1 person is concerned in it. This person might be, is doubtless, labouring under some terrible form of insanity, as each of the crimes has been of a most fiendish character, and it is feared that unless he can speedily be captured, more outrages of a similar class will be committed. Inquest on Mary Ann Nichols, September the 4th to the 24th. Testimony of William Nichols. Nichols, a machinist, stated that the deceased woman was his wife. He had been separated from her for upwards of 8 years. The last time he saw her was over 3 years ago, and he had no idea what she had been doing since that time, nor with whom she lived. Deceased was much given to drink. They separated several times, and each time he took her back she got drunk, and that was why he had to leave her altogether. Statement of the coroner. Referring to the facts in the case before him, the coroner said the deceased had been identified by her father and her husband to have been Mary Ann Nichols, a married woman with 5 children and about 42 years of age. It was pretty clear that she had been living an intemperate, irregular, and vicious life, mostly in the common lodging houses in that neighbourhood. On Friday evening, the 31st of August, she was seen by Mrs. Holland, who knew her well, at the corner of Osborne Street and Whitechapel Road, nearly opposite the church. The deceased woman was then much the worse for drink, and was staggering against the wall. Her friend endeavoured to persuade her to come home with her, but she declined, and was last seen endeavouring to walk eastward down Whitechapel. She said she had had her lodging money 3 times that day, but that she had spent it, that she was going about to get some money to pay her lodgings, and she would soon be back. In less than an hour and a quarter after this, she was found dead at a spot rather under 3/4 of a mile distant. The condition in which the body was found appeared to prove conclusively that the deceased was killed on the exact spot in which she was found. There was not a trace of blood anywhere except at the spot where her neck was lying. That appeared to the coroner sufficient to justify the assumption that the injuries to the throat were inflicted when the woman was on the ground, while the state of her clothing and the absence of any blood about her legs equally proved that the abdominal injuries were inflicted while she was still in the same position. Nor did there appear any grounds for doubt that, if deceased was killed where she was found, she met her death without cry of any kind. The spot was almost under the windows of Mrs. Green, a light sleeper. It was opposite the bedroom of Mrs. Perkis, who was awake at the time. Then there were watchmen at various spots within very short distances. Not a sound was heard by any, nor was there evidence of any struggle. This might have arisen from her intoxication or from being stunned by a blow. It seemed astonishing, at first thought, that the culprit should escape detection, for there must surely have been marks of blood about his person. If, however, blood was principally on his hands, the presence of so many slaughterhouses in the neighbourhood would make the frequenters of that spot familiar with blood-stained clothes and hands, and his appearance might in that way have failed to attract attention while he passed from Buck's Row in the twilight into Whitechapel Road, and was lost sight of in the morning's market of traffic. He himself thought they could not altogether have unnoticed the fact that the death the jury had been investigating was one of 4 presenting many points of similarity, all of which had occurred within the space of about 5 months, and all within a very short distance of the place where they were sitting. All 4 victims were women of middle age, all were married and had lived apart from their husbands in consequence of intemperate habits, and were at the time of their death leading irregular lives and eking out a miserable and precarious existence in common lodging houses. In each case there were abdominal as well as other injuries. In each case the injuries were inflicted after midnight, and in places of public resort, where it would appear impossible but that almost immediate detection would follow the crime, and in each case the inhuman and dastardly criminals were at large in society. Emma Elizabeth Smith, who received the injuries in Osborne Street on the early morning of Easter Tuesday, the 3rd of April, survived in the London hospital for upwards of 24 hours, and was able to state that she had been followed by some men, robbed and mutilated, and even to describe imperfectly one of them. Martha Tabram was found at 3 a.m. on Tuesday, the 7th of August, on the first floor landing of Gregory Yard Buildings, with 39 puncture wounds on the body. In addition to these, and the case under consideration of the jury, there was the case of Annie Chapman, still in the hands of another jury. The instruments used in the 2 earlier cases were dissimilar. In the first, it was a blunt instrument, such as a walking stick. In the second, some of the wounds were thought to have been made by a dagger. But in the 2 recent cases, the instruments suggested by the medical witnesses were not so different. Dr. Llewellyn said that the injuries on Nichols could have been produced by a very sharp knife, probably with a thin, narrow blade, at least 6 inches to 8 inches in length, probably longer. The similarity of the injuries in the two cases was considerable. There were bruises about the face in both cases. The head was nearly severed from the body in both cases. And those injuries again had in each case been performed with anatomical knowledge. Dr. Llewellyn seemed to incline to the opinion that the abdominal injuries were inflicted first and caused instantaneous death. But if so, it seemed difficult to understand the object of such desperate injuries to the throat, or how it came about there was so little bleeding from the severed arteries that the clothing on the upper surface was not stained and the legs not soiled, and that there was very much less bleeding from the abdomen than from the neck. Surely it might well be that, as in the case of Chapman, the dreadful wounds to the throat were first inflicted and the abdominal afterwards. That was a matter of some importance when they came to consider what possible motive there could be for all this ferocity. Robbery was out of the question, and there was nothing to suggest jealousy. There could not have been any quarrel, or it would have been heard. The taking of some of the abdominal viscera from the body of Chapman suggested that they may have been the object of her death. Was it not possible that this may have been the motive in the case they had under consideration? He suggested to the jury as a possibility that the two women might have been murdered by the same man with the same object, and that in the case of Nichols the wretch was disturbed before he had accomplished his object, and having failed in the open street, he tried again, within a week of his failure, in a more secluded place. If this was correct, the audacity and daring was equal to its maniacal fanaticism and abhorrent wickedness. But the surmise might or might not be correct. Inquest on Annie Chapman, September the 11th to the 27th. Statement of the coroner. The deceased was a widow, 47 years of age, named Annie Chapman. Her husband was a coachman living at Windsor. For 3 or 4 years before his death, she had lived apart from her husband, who allowed her 10 shillings a week until his death, Christmas 1886. She had evidently lived an immoral life for some time, and her habits and surroundings had become worse since her means had failed. She lived principally in the common lodging-houses in the neighbourhood of Spitalfields, where such as she herded like cattle. She showed signs of great deprivation, as if she had been badly fed. The glimpse of life in those dens which the evidence in this case disclosed was sufficient to make the jury feel there was much in the 19th-century civilization of which they had small reason to be proud. But the jury, who were constantly called together to hear the sad tale of starvation or semi-starvation, of misery, immorality and wickedness, which some of the occupants of the 5,000 beds in that district had every week to relate at coroner's inquests, did not require to be reminded what a life in a Spitalfields lodging-house meant. It was in one of those houses that the older bruises found on the temple and in front of the chest of the deceased were received, in a trumpery quarrel, a week before her death. It was in one of those that she was seen, a few hours before her mangled remains were discovered. On the afternoon and evening of Friday, the 7th of September, she spent her time partly in such a place, at 35 Dorset Street, and partly in the Ringer's public house, where she spent whatever money she had. So that between 1 and 2 o'clock on the morning of Saturday, when the money for the bed was demanded, she was obliged to admit that she was without means, and at once turned out into the street to find it. She left there at 1:45 a.m. On her wedding finger she was wearing 2 or 3 rings, which appeared to have been palpably of base metal, as the witnesses were all clear about their material and value. They now lost sight of her for about 4 hours, but at 5:30, Mrs. Long was in Hanbury Street, on the way to Spitalfields Market. Testimony of Elizabeth Long. Mrs. Long stated that on Saturday morning the 8th, she was passing down Hanbury Street from home and going to Spitalfields Market. It was about 5:30. She was certain of the time, as the brewer's clock had just struck that time when she passed 29 Hanbury Street. She saw a man and a woman on the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?